ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Thursday, the 6th of November. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, the boss of NAB says housing is Australia's biggest challenge. And breakup albums aren't new, but Lily Allen's has stirred debate on marriage and divorce and privacy and publicity.
And I thought that was quite strange.
I guess, you know, as an artist that's 40 and sharing, you know, intimate details about their life in a way that's, you know, also mixed with incredible production and musicality it's a bit of a game changer record.
New York City's mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani has vowed to tackle what he called the twin crises facing his constituents, affordability and the Trump administration. There were no pleasantries coming the other way either, the president labelling Mamdani as a communist. But it's not just the New York results that will be a political thorn in the side of the Republicans, with Democrats sweeping in the first major elections since Donald Trump regained office. Tanya Dendrinos reports.
Last night, we made history. I'm so proud to be standing here today as the mayor-elect of the greatest city in the world.
It's been a meteoric rise for 34-year-old Zohran Mamdani.
The poetry of campaigning may have come to a close last night at 9, but the beautiful prose of governing has only just begun.
New York City's mayor-elect has already made some big promises.
New Yorkers are facing twin crises in this moment. An authoritarian administration and an affordability crisis. And it'll be my job to deliver on both. It'll be my job to stand up for the city and also to ensure that we do not look at Washington, D.C. as if it is the reason for all of the problems right here in New York City. Many of the issues we are speaking about, they predate President Trump. They are issues that for too long we have turned a blind eye to or we have sought to rationalize or normalize.
President Trump alluded to the rivalry on social media, posting, "And so it begins," shortly after the result. Today, he elaborated.
If you want to see what congressional Democrats wish to do to America, just look at the result of yesterday's election in New York, where their party installed a communist as the mayor of the largest city in the nation. Remember, I've said we will never have a socialist elected to any post in our country. I used to say that, and I was right. We skipped socialist and we put in a communist instead. That didn't work out too well.
But Zohran Mamdani isn't a communist. He's a self-described democratic socialist. He's New York's first Muslim and South Asian mayor-elect and became the first candidate to pass 1 million votes since 1969. But Amisha Cross, a democratic strategist and former campaign advisor to Barack Obama, says there is a parallel that can be drawn between the political rivals.
In some ways, Mamdani, even though he's obviously on a different side of the political spectrum, in some ways his campaign mirrored Trump's first campaign. They wanted somebody who was seen as an outsider, somebody who didn't have an elongated political past. They wanted somebody who spoke about change and brought about something that was different. Barack Obama had that same quality. Obviously, these are things that matter to American voters, no matter what city they're in.
Yesterday marked a much-needed boost for the Democratic Party following the bruising 2024 presidential campaign. On top of the New York mayoral vote, there were also decisive Democratic wins in gubernatorial races in Virginia and New Jersey. Matt Klink is a Republican strategist and the owner of Klink Campaigns.
These are both states that Donald Trump lost in November of 2024. They're just in a snarky mood. You know, they're looking at affordability and economic issues. And even though Trump has held office for 9 months, they're not happy. And they took it out yesterday on the Republican candidates. And I think that, you know, Abigail Sparnberger in Virginia, Mickey Sherrill in New Jersey, they were moderate candidates. And I think that they really talked about kitchen table issues, and they avoided getting into the caustic rhetoric.
Meanwhile, in his home state of California, voters approved a plan to redraw the state's congressional map.
our governor, Gavin Newsom, was successful in making it a, you know, vote to protect California and fight against Donald Trump. And it passed with 65% of the votes last night. So in blue states, absolutely, they are not happy. In purple states, which Virginia could rightfully be called a purple state, I think that there are some people that are happy and some that aren't. And the ones that aren't turned out and voted yesterday. Mm.
The contests are the first major barometer of how Americans are feeling as the nation looks towards next year's midterm elections.
Odds are that the Republicans will lose the House of Representatives next year because they only have a 5-seat majority and the party out of power picks up about 20 to 25 seats. So that would mean we would have a Democratic Speaker of the House. But the Republicans, because of which states are up in the Senate, they're likely to hold the Senate. So you're going to have divided government no matter what. And Donald Trump still has, I mean, he hasn't even been in office 1 year yet.
Republican strategist Matt Klink ending that report by Tanya Dendrinos. Well, staying in the United States, it's officially the longest government shutdown in US history. And some of the numbers are truly staggering. For 36 days now, some 670,000 federal workers have been furloughed. Another 730,000 are working without pay. 42 million Americans are waiting on food stamps. And 3.2 million airline passengers have been met with delays or cancellations caused by the shutdown. But that may be just the tip of the iceberg. Associate Professor Susanna Ali is the director of the Master of Public Administration program at Florida International University. She joined me earlier. Professor, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
Much of your research centers on how turbulent politics sort of filter into employees' daily lives. And since the shutdown began on October 15, when Democrats and Republicans failed to reach a deal on federal government funding, what have been some of the side effects to everyday life in the U.S.?
So I think there are some quiet side effects that people don't necessarily see directly, but a lot of things that normally would happen quickly are happening slowly. So we know things like employees not being paid, and we are currently struggling with people who are beneficiaries of food assistance having reduced amounts and some battles in the courts about, you know, paying them at all. But there are also other ways. So loans are being slow to be processed, or if they are getting grant money to do research or to do work, that's happening slowly. And a lot of the money that goes to state and local governments to do the work that needs to happen every day isn't there. And it's also see things like parks being closed, you know, airport delays. There's just a lot of ways in day-to-day life that are loudly or quietly being compromised.
In this period of the U.S. federal shutdown, there are two kind of designations for workers. One is accepted and one is non-accepted. What do those mean?
Yeah, it's a funny term because 10 years ago, they said essential and non-essential. And people found that to be very hurtful because, you know, if you were deemed non-essential, what were you doing for all those hours that you were working? So now within agencies, managers are asked to look at their team and say, how many people do you really, really need to be working? Is there just no way that you can send them home? And those people are deemed not accepted, and the others are then sent home and furloughed. But there's a real fairness issue there because it could be that the person sitting at the desk next to you goes home and you are expected to continue to work without pay. Eventually, all of the federal workers will be paid when government reopens, but yeah, these aren't necessarily particularly wealthy people. I mean, they're making nice living, but a lot of them are really living from paycheck to paycheck.
You've studied what happened with federal workers in previous U.S. government shutdowns. Do people hang on? I mean, if you say they're living from paycheck to paycheck, do they leave or stay? Do they go and try and find work in the private sector? What's happening?
Yeah, I think a lot of people do. It depends on where they are in their career. I mean, if you've been working for the government for 20 years, you're less likely to go and look for something else. You're probably going to say, I've weathered the last storm and I'll weather this storm as well. But for people who are earlier on in their career, they really do have this personal crisis. Is this really where I want to be? Is this how I want to spend, you know, the next 5, 10, 20 years of my professional life? So you're also compounding with that with mass firings in the federal government in the last 6 months. So people are seeing that they no longer have the security that they once had. They're seeing that they're asked to work for jobs where they may or may not get paid for unknown amounts of time. This could become very regular. This could be an annual stress for people. And I think there are real questions about people, how long they will stay, how long they will put up with that.
Clearly, the scars in terms of workplace relations in the federal government will continue for some time. More holistically, across the economy and the labour market, what do you think those long-term consequences will be?
Yeah, I think it's a slowing down overall, right? Because all of that money that normally flows from the federal government into the private sector, into nonprofits, into state and local governments is compromised. So that means that all of those entities are going to hold back on their spending, and they're going to make decisions, delay decisions about hiring people. You know, a lot of work related to the federal government is contract work. So while federal employees will be paid for their time missed, a lot of contractors, they're just not being paid at all. And they have really serious business decisions that they have to make about whether they subsidize these contracts or not. And then when they go back into future contracts with the federal government, do they have to build in higher expenses so that they can be sure that they can cover it if there's a shutdown again?
Associate Professor Susanna Ali is the director of the Master of Public Administration program at Florida International University. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. Back home now, and the boss of NAB says housing is Australia's biggest challenge. The country's third biggest lender has recorded a slight fall in full-year profit to $6.8 billion. Cash earnings were steady at $7.1 billion. Shareholders will get a final dividend of 85 cents a share. CEO Andrew Irvin spoke to business presenter Alicia Barry and said the country needs to urgently boost housing supply.
Andrew Irvin, thank you for joining World Today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
The housing crisis in Australia is often described as though housing is eating the economy. How would you categorise it?
Look, housing is the single biggest societal and policy challenge facing our country. Simply put, we need more dwellings to be built to enable the dream of home ownership for young Australian families, and also to enable more migrants to come to our shores and have a place to live. So it's an incredibly important topic. And the real thing that we focus on and encourage government of all levels to push into is increasing the supply of dwellings and making it easier for builders and developers to get new homes built.
Are you confident Australia can meet the supply challenge?
Not yet. I think we are seeing green shoots. We are seeing some improvement, but we continue to need to lean into this category and focus hard on it. We don't yet have enough confidence that we're going to get to the numbers that we need to see.
The RBA is unlikely to cut interest rates well into the middle of next year. Can your home loan customers hang on until then?
The economy's improving. We're seeing GDP growth at 2% this year, accelerating to 2.3% next year. And so most households are seeing an improvement in their economic outcomes, and we're seeing hardship levels decreasing. To give you a perspective on that, in the three interest rate cuts that the RBA has provided this year, 80% of our customers have chosen to keep their payments at the same level. So essentially, they're repaying their home loan faster than they otherwise would have. 20% have chosen to reduce their payments. And so I think that's reflective of where things are at in the country. There are still pockets of hardship. And my comment for anybody out there is, if you're having a tough time, call your bank, call NAB, and we'll see how we can help you.
Now, your climate report is out today. The bank is working toward net zero by 2050. Do you think it's important that the country be on the same page when it comes to climate goals, given the politicking we're seeing in Canberra?
You know, generally, these are very, very long-term business decisions. And so I think business people like certainty and stability so that you can make a decision and be confident that the economics over the course of that investment are going to remain stable. What I would say, and this is incredibly important for Australia, is that we need more energy. We need more renewable energy. And we need more gas, particularly on the eastern seaboard. There is no transition to renewables without gas and the firming that that provides to the electricity network. So let's get projects approved, both renewable and gas, get more energy, and that's going to provide Australians with reliable and cheap energy to support household consumption and business growth.
Andrew Irvin, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Irvin is the National Australia Bank CEO. He was speaking there to Alicia Barry. Australia's first Centre for Disease Control will open its doors in January after legislation for the Canberra-based operation passed Parliament in Canberra. The federal government promises the National Centre will improve Australia's response and preparedness for public health emergencies, such as the H5 bird flu, which has killed hundreds of animals and people worldwide. But it's left some experts with questions on how it will address chronic illness and what powers will be stripped from state and territory leaders across the country. Here's Rachel Mealy.
From January the 1st, a dedicated group of scientists and medical professionals will have the power to influence public health decisions across the country. The Minister for the National Disability Insurance Scheme, Jenny McAllister, introduced the bill to the Senate yesterday.
Data will be at the heart of the CDC's work. The COVID-19 inquiry highlighted a critical weakness in our pandemic response. Decisions were often made without sufficient evidence due to fragmented and inaccessible data, and this bill addresses that gap. The CDC will lead the development of a modern approach to national public health data that enables faster detection of risks, more consistent responses across jurisdictions, and stronger foundations for planning.
Federal Health Minister Mark Butler says it will ensure Australia is better prepared for future health crises.
Well, the most important thing will be independence. I mean, what we learned from the COVID inquiry report was that there was a huge appetite for an independent authoritative agency in Australia to provide public health advice and to do that in an independent, transparent way.
Handpicked by the federal government, the Centre for Disease Control, or CDC, will include a range of experts, including epidemiologists, statisticians, and public health practitioners, all working under the same roof in Canberra. The CDC will deal with any current and emerging health threats facing Australians and provide medical advice to state and territory leaders. Issues like H5 avian influenza, the rapid decline of vaccination rates, and gathering information on possible future outbreaks like COVID-19.
Yeah, if I want anything, one thing from the CDC, I want it to start rebuilding trust. We know that will be a long road. Mm-hmm. Trust is easily lost. It's hard to win back, but the CDC is central to our plan to do that. This is a really crucial reform.
The centre will also be tasked with solving Australia's biggest health challenge, chronic disease, but not until at least 2028. The CSIRO, the Australian Institute for Infectious Disease, as well as the chief medical officers within state and territory governments, are already tackling this issue. The health minister says the CDC won't focus on it just yet.
The first job of the CDC to get it up and running, to establish the systems, particularly the data systems, and establish trust within the health sector and the community more broadly, is to be based on infectious disease. I mean, that's really the area which led to our decision to put in place a CDC. So pandemic preparedness, but also a whole lot of the day-to-day, year-by-year infectious disease or communicable disease challenges we have, HIV, hepatitis, hepatitis, respiratory viruses and things like that.
Terry Slevin is the Chief Executive of the Public Health Association of Australia. He says the new centre will consolidate health information.
Ultimately, its role is to provide advice, and that advice has to be free of political interference.
He says one of the challenges in establishing the CDC has been deciding where its responsibility ends and state and territory jurisdiction begins.
State and territory leaders have the power to make the decisions under their responsibility consistent with their powers and legislation. That's not going to change. But if any jurisdiction wants to take a rogue approach towards a public health matter, then they're going to have to deal with challenges in their own backyard if they're taking advice other than that which is provided by an entity like the CDC.
Terry Slevin from the Public Health Association of Australia, ending that report by Rachel Mealy and Kathleen O'Connor. It's a brutal, vulnerable window into a breakup, and it's taken the internet and music fans by storm. Lily Allen's latest album, West End Girl, has become something of a cultural phenomenon, and it's showing no signs of slowing down. Spotify showing the album's streams doubled in the week after its release. Bridget Fitzgerald takes a look at the album that's morphed into broader commentary about marriage and divorce, privacy and publicity.
UK musician Lily Allen and American actor David Harbour are getting a divorce. Why? Well, Allen's latest album gives us a fair idea.
I said I got some good news, I got the lead in a play. That's when your demeanour started to change. You said I'd have to audition, I said you're deranged. And I thought that was quite strange.
The opening track from West End Girl tells a detailed story about moving to a new city before some kind of relationship rupture that later implies Harbour asked Allen for an open marriage before she reveals he cheated on her. While Lily Allen has been clear the album is a mix of fact and fiction, she says it is about the breakdown of her marriage to Harbour, and audiences can't get enough.
I loved it. The reason I loved it was because it was such a surprise. There was no real teaser around the record coming out.
Eliza Hull is a musician, writer and Double J presenter.
I guess, you know, as an artist that's 40, we're exactly the same age, Lily Allen and I, to hear an artist really coming into their power, speaking the truth and sharing, you know, intimate details about their life in a way that's, you know, also mixed with incredible production and musicality was, yeah, it's a bit of a game changer record.
There are reports downloads of the album on streaming giant Spotify doubled in the week after it was released in late October, and first-time listeners to Lily Allen were up 375%. So what's causing such a stir? Is it that audiences are hungry for scandal and to learn all we can about a celebrity marriage? Eliza Hull says it's deeper than that.
I think, you know, sharing intimate details about infidelity is something that a lot of us can relate to. And I think also just that kind of feminist lens on that is something that I connected to, and I've noticed that the fans have as well.
And who's Madeline?
The internet is also alive with fans hunting for clues about the relationship breakdown. This Architectural Digest footage from 2023 of their home in New York has resurfaced, with David Harbour starting off with this joke.
Oh God, what the hell are you doing here? I mean, last time I was single and I was living on the Lower East Side, I have a family now, kids. I mean, this is so embarrassing. You look good though.
Lily Allen was dropping some hints too.
We have this double-sided sofa, which means David and I can argue and sort of be looking at each other
and then face away
at the same time.
Liz Dufresne is an associate professor in media at the University of Technology, Sydney, and a pop music and culture specialist.
It's interesting though that, you know, if we're thinking about control or shame or any of those places where people might be at a relative power deficit, there is a gendered thing, isn't there? There is, I guess, an expectation that if there's a heartbreak song, that somehow it's more acceptable in a heterosexual relationship for a man to be a heartbreaker, and we've got all of that. That's what rock and roll gives us. The women who are on the other side of that are just meant to say nothing.
Reviews and online comments have referred to the album as being about female empowerment. Dr. Dufresne says Alan has used honesty to regain control of her own story.
There's a lot of songs that talk about that process of finding out. You know, so the other one, Pussy Palace, you know, if there's any shame to be had, is it the person who's been lying, or is it the person that's been lied to? You know, we've got that weird kind of power play that's been told for us all as part of this album. I'll talk about love.
Good advice for life there. Treat people like it's all going to end up on an album one day. Pop music and culture specialist Dr. Liz Dufresne, ending that report by Bridget Fitzgerald. And that's all from The World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It's a dark cloud that's hovered over her Liberal Party leadership since the beginning. And now the Nationals have officially canned net zero. The pressure is on for Susan Lee to do the same. Today, Chief Political Correspondent at The Conversation, Michelle Grattan, on whether Australian voters are willing to give up on the key emission reduction target. Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on the ABC Listen app.